Welcome, everyone. My name is Michael S. Siebert. You're listening to Equal Chance to Be Unequal, my podcast about unlocking human potential through helping people disconnected from their purpose, uncover and live their purpose. Welcome, everyone, to today's episode of Equal Chance to Be Unequal. I am your host, Michael S. Siebert. Thank you for joining us today. Today, I have a special guest. His name is Bill Koch. Bill is a consultant who not only consults, but also coaches executive leaders and has done it in Fortune 500 private enterprises and in academia. Brings a very, very unique perspective to his work. He's been working in C-suite and been in the game for probably 25 plus years, including being the CEO of a Fortune 500 subsidiary. He does serve on investment fund boards, two corporate boards, and community and professional organizations. I think he's based in the Dallas area. Bill coaches with methods and systems that lead to peak performance and to life balance, which I'm a huge fan of. And I love the fact that he uses a systematic approach to guiding clients through a sequential process or stages of leadership mastery and maturity. He, as I mentioned a second ago, he did serve as a CEO for a subsidiary of AMR Corporation, an affiliate of American Airlines, has been a leader in the business aviation industry for a while, serving as chairman of the National Air Transportation Association, has some experiences in commercial real estate, technology, and has served as CEO and chairman of large firms backed by private equity funds. Bill and I are both member of something referred to as the Forbes Coaches Council. Bill and I were joking in the pre-show that he has way more certifications than I have. He is an associate certified coach through the International Coach Federation and also has certifications in the Leadership Circle Profile, the Hogan Leadership Assessments, Korn Ferry's Lominger Voices 360 Assessment, and does have a BA Political Science from Southern Methodist. And with that short introduction, Bill, I would like to welcome you to Equal Chance to Be Unequal.
Michael, thank you for that. And it's good to be with you. And I just want to say that I really admire the work that you're doing and the questions that you're asking and the way that you're inviting people to explore kind of new ways of thinking about what makes a meaningful life. So thanks for that.
You're welcome. And thank you for saying that. We're going through these massive transitions in society right now. And as we think about all of the things that can be happening, I think there's a duty upon folks, and especially folks who have the experience like you or me in moving a person from point A to point B, that the more that we can share our ideas with leaders and get this content out there, that there's the bigger possibility that we can create a really, really cool society that our kids would want to live in.
Yeah, make the world a better place.
Agreed. So I gave a little bit of context and history about you, Bill. You want to fill in any gaps there? Talk a little bit about any other accomplishments or wins or historical context for you.
Well, I would say today that I just feel really privileged to be doing this work, primarily as an executive coach, working one-on-one with business leaders. I kind of see it as a personal mission to bring authentic leadership practices to the world by helping people discover just the inherent abilities that they have to attract and inspire others to do good. And that's, you know, do well in their business and do good in the world. So I'm a big believer in conscious capitalism. I love working with companies and individuals who feel a sense of a higher calling. You know, just a little background, you outlined it, 25 years of real world working experience and was a young CEO. That appointment at AMR was at age 34. I look back on that now and I think, what were they thinking? They said, you know, this guy's got all the right stuff, but they attached an executive coach to me in that role at that young age, and it was just a phenomenal experience. It was so great to have a guide, a mentor, somebody who could ask me the right questions in my environment to question my decisions, my behaviors, you know, evaluate my performance. He took me through a 360 process. He helped me identify a few areas that with really subtle changes, I could dramatically increase my effectiveness as a leader in that role. That was one time. And at a later point in my career, much more mature, in my late 40s, I had another opportunity to go through a 360 assessment process and get some very specific feedback. I mean, look, going through 360s, it can be a really good thing. You get a lot of positive feedback, but always we're looking for development opportunities. And I found a few about my own behavior as a leader where I was showing up as a nice guy, I mean, as a diplomat, which was something that had actually served me pretty well for a lot of years. But I was in a role where we were trying to grow rapidly by acquisitions and be decisive. And my behavior was actually slowing us down. I was seeking approval of board members, kind of, you know, having meetings before the meetings and doing things that were not in the best interest of the business. So I got this valuable feedback, and it allowed me to shift my behavior, gave me permission to lead in the way that was needed. And we went full throttle and had a great outcome in the years that followed, I think, largely as a result of that shift in my behavior as a leader. So I know this stuff works from my own experience in the business world. I just always had a fascination with organizational behavior, leadership. I mean, these were just areas of interest to me. And I do distinctly remember in working with a coach that I felt that's work that I want to do one day. Today, I just feel it's a privilege to do this at this point in my career.
Yeah, well said. And thank you for that. As we think about that, you and I were talking in the pre-show about, you know, the various things that shape us and get us to where we're at in life. And it's oftentimes those people that are around us that help us and guide us and give us awareness of ourselves, and those trigger feelings and emotions and experiences in us that ultimately guide some of the things that we do later. So I think it very serendipitous that you would have been blessed with an independent third party at a really young age to be CEO, right? At age 34, which is fantastic. And that person would have guided you. And here we are now a few years later, and you get to be that person for other CEOs and C-suite members who are looking for that same guidance. I think you've come full circle in some way.
Well, exactly. And that's just kind of gives me chills to think that I get to do that at this point. And I would say that kind of characterizes a good portion of my coaching work. I am drawn to super high achievers, high performers who have recently been promoted to a really big job, and they have finally sort of met their match. They have met their own human capacity limits and come to realize that, oh, this job is bigger than me. I can't pull an all-nighter and pull it off anymore.
Right? Yeah.
I need to get work done through others. Now the conversation is more about inspiration and attraction, leadership qualities, rather than the tactics of managing a business as they've done in the past.
Oh my gosh. Yes, I so agree. And also in the pre-show, we were talking about some experiences I've had recently with teams who weren't exactly displaying higher levels of emotional intelligence. And to hear what you just said about as you climb the ladder, your technical skill and ability will do beautiful things for you at the early to middle parts of your career. But once you get later on, right, we need the folks like Bill in our lives to help us understand that EQ is going to trump IQ in many ways.
It is the difference that makes the difference. and especially right at that point. It's a competitive business world. Organizations will compete for the highest IQ personnel, and they'll just keep ratcheting that up. But the difference that makes the difference is EQ. I'm a huge fan of Daniel Goleman's work and did a lot of study with him and with Annie McKee, one of his chief researchers, to really come to appreciate how important this is. Now, I mean, in a nutshell, it's everything I learned from my mother. It's everything I learned in kindergarten. It's people skills.
Yep.
It really is people skills. How we manage ourselves and how we manage relationship with others. But it's pretty much the most important thing. And I will tell you from lots and lots and lots of, you know, 360 reviews with clients in recent years, nobody has ever shown up as being incompetent in terms of their knowledge, but almost everyone has had issues around EQ and opportunities for growth in that area.
I use an assessment where it's a little bit of the how and what of communication and then the why of our behavior. But then it also looks at the kind of EQ component. And one of the things that I find executives ranking themselves really low on is capacity for self-regulation. And maybe you've seen something similar, but it has always struck me, even in those moments of stress, there's still those default behaviors that each of our respective styles kind of goes to. And in a world that is as fast-paced as we are, we get to those points of stress really quickly. Have you seen that too?
Totally. And, yeah. And quite honestly, this is all about how we behave under stress, because that's when we're triggered and we go into reactive patterns of behavior. And everybody has them. We all have them, but we need to understand what are our innate patterns of behavior and then be able to make a conscious decision to adjust that behavior. So stress is the trigger, and it happens, as you point out, more and more frequently, more and more intensely every day, it seems, in the world that we live in. With all of these triggers in our environment, all the more reason why to have the tools to consciously pause and make a decision about how I will respond to that stimulus rather than react. That's the difference maker right there. What's the behavior that I'm going to choose that would be a better decision than what my reaction would have been. Game changer.
Yeah, I love it. Okay, good. Thank you for that, Bill. So let's turn back the clock a little bit, a number of years, and let's walk the listener a little bit through your journey from some of those younger, more formative years to today. Like, tell me a little bit about your story.
Well, I think on reflection, I'd say I probably have a long history of being an overachiever or a super achiever.
Okay.
And I was one who had, you know, that experience of kind of bumping into my own limitations later in my career. So, you know, having grown up in a Fortune 500 environment was a great place to learn the fundamentals of business and how things work and how to get things done. It was a large, somewhat political, you know, organization. This was in the 80s. There was an interesting shift going on from, I think, the old days, the old ways of command and control management, which had prevailed up until that time. And a shift was happening just as I entered the workforce. You know, I came from a set of family values that, you know, my father told me, son, you choose to work for a good company and, you know, be good to them and they'll take care of you. You know, and that was my father's experience. And he had a wonderful career with one company his whole life. And that has not been true for my generation. And it's certainly not true today.
Yeah.
So I think today we have to, as individuals, build our own brand, know who we are, know what we stand for, and align our own objectives with the organizations that we affiliate with. So I think I was experiencing that transition in the making. But I had 12 years in that company, a wonderful collection of mentors, people I worked with who showed me the way. And it was a company with wonderful values, really focused on customer service, operational efficiency and performance standards, and financial performance. And we were running on all cylinders and doing really, really well. As I said, a good place to kind of grow up and learn the fundamentals of a good business. You know, I'm not sure in those days that things were done as consciously as they are today. There just wasn't as much good research and good books. I think Peter Drucker was probably the best business mind, you know, that prevailed at that time. As I kind of got further into my career, I was just so delighted to find Jim Collins' work. And it was going on in the 90s and kind of came out early 2000s on Good to Great and Built to Last. I mean, those are the models for the kind of business that I want to run and the business that I had been a part of. As I'm reading the stories of the Good to Great companies, I'm like, yes, okay, that's where I grew up and that's what I want to emulate in my leadership role. So very powerful, positive impact for me. And then came, you know, Daniel Goleman's work. Also, that came out in 99 on emotional intelligence. And quite honestly, Goleman's work was HR people embraced it pretty early, but CEOs were not all there at that time. And again, it was kind of a changing of the guard was occurring. And I think we needed some more open-minded, you know, thinkers to accept and embrace emotional intelligence as being such a difference maker. You know, what's really interesting is that the first thing that was published was an article in Harvard Business Review called What Makes a Leader? And it's about a 8-page article that's in essence Goleman's 400-page book condensed to, you know, just the fundamentals. And to this day, now 20 years later, it's still the number one selling HBR article in reprint.
Wow.
Called What Makes a Leader? Daniel Goleman in 1999. So I recommend it if you want the very essence of his message, which has not changed, you know, since that time.
Wow.
But it's certainly been widely embraced.
Yeah. You think, and I really appreciate your comments, Bill, about, you know, this kind of transition. And I was too young at the time to really thoroughly understand or know. But when you think about the 80s and the kind of the transition more into free market capitalism, and Reagan and Thatcher were really, really pushing that as an approach to life. And if we think about what happened in the 80s and the 90s and the early 2000s, there was a lot of really significant societal norms and changes and shifts. Globalization and technology all of a sudden became big in the late 90s. And the values that your dad passed along to you were really, really critical. But there had to be an awareness that your life was not going to be overly similar to his, right? So he had cradle-to-grave employment. And then you have been able to bounce around and have an impact in lots of different organizations and probably at a pretty different level than what he did. And so society continues to evolve and change in that way. And it seems like it's happening at an even faster pace.
Totally. The pace is quickening dramatically. But I remember having, when I was into my third job, you know, in my career, that it was almost like I was ashamed to tell my dad, yeah, I'm changing jobs again.
Yep.
Because that was such a strong sort of set of values. But, you know, today he certainly sees it for what it is and how much the world has changed. But,
Oh, gosh.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, you think about millennials, and you've clearly had to work with many of them throughout your journey. And I think it was October of 2015, that according to Goldman Sachs, they became the largest percentage of the American workforce at, you know, 36 or 37% at the time. And projections are that they'll be 75% by 2025. You know, to think about the disruption that they're going to cause because of the societal norms and things that existed while they were being raised and as they were kind of in their formative years and kind of forming out what their personal missions might be, the leaders today really have to evolve and adjust how they engage them, because what you or I might have been raised in terms of what employee engagement meant then is really different today.
Exactly. And so I deal with very senior level executives on this issue every day. You know, so some of them see that as a threat. It's like this wave of millennials coming on. And I try to help them see that as an opportunity, as an invitation to bring them in, give them a seat at the table. Now, I don't mean you have to make them a VP and give them a corner office and a car, because that's what older executives think that millennials want.
Right.
That's the stereotype. So my hope, though, is that an older senior executive will literally bring their millennial members of their organization to the table for the purposes of a conversation. And I'd say, and make it a round table. I mean, don't sit at the head of a long boardroom table. Have a round table discussion with lots of millennials at the table so that you can all better come to understand each other. And what are your wants and what are your needs? Because right now there's a big disconnect in most organizations. To your point, you know, like you said, in a few years, 75% of our workforce is, you know, will be millennial generations. Now, I think millennials are generally unfairly characterized. It's like a caricature that 5 years from now, you know, they're all older, all more mature. I think every generation goes through this. You know, every younger generation is perceived by the older one to be maverick.
Exactly. Yep. That's so well said. And I remember the Center for Creative Leadership back in probably the late 90s, early 2000s, one of their staff, Jennifer Deal, wrote a book called Retiring the Generation Gap. And it was a really interesting look at 10 ways or 10 principles by which all humans, regardless of generation, were the same. It's a really good look at the way that humans really, really are. And so we have to be a little bit less aware of the generation and a little bit more aware of the phase that person is in life. And if we can get, you know, these executive leaders that you and I serve to more focus in on, where is this person in their phase or their transition in life? Are they pre-assets? Are they pre-parenting? Are they pre-owning a home? Whatever those things are, that's going to shape their capacity to serve your organization.
And what's needed most is empathy and understanding for those people where they are.
Yep. Yeah.
And the fact that we need all these members of our team contributing and aligned to organizational goals and objectives that they can all relate to and all connect with.
Yeah. As you were talking, Bill, it made me think about feedback loops. And I, you know, I don't know about the folks you serve, but I sure struggle with some of the folks I serve that the feedback loops just don't exist. And so the younger folks or the folks on the front lines of a respective business, they're not given the seat at the table to really provide feedback about what a customer or an employee engagement tactic or some sort of a compensation or benefit tactic is actually doing on the front line. Have you seen those feedback loops work inside some of the businesses that you're serving, or do they not yet exist?
The ones that work are the ones that are in great organizations doing great work, who are connected to their customers and their employees are engaged. So yeah, when all of those things are working, they're working together, you've got a successful company. If there's that disconnect, you know, it's certainly dangerous.
Yeah.
It's dangerous for the future. I would not be investing. I would not be betting on that company if they have that disconnect, particularly with, you know, with the millennial members of their workforce.
Sure. So,
because as you know, so millennials are the best and the brightest. And today they're just not patient. They're not going to sit and wait 15 years, you know, for time to elevate them to a position where they ultimately get a voice at the table. They have real ideas that want to be heard and that need to be heard now. And we've got to find, organizationally, we've got to find better, different ways to connect them. Let them be heard. Let them be a part of the contribution to the important decisions in the organization.
Yeah.
Let them have a voice. It doesn't mean they have to have, you know, a senior title today, but they do need a voice.
Yeah, I agree. So well said. Have you seen in any of the clients you've served or even in the businesses that you've run, what are some examples of feedback loops that seem to give those folks a voice?
Well, you know, in the old days, we used to call it management by wandering around.
I like that. Yeah.
For senior executives to get out as close as possible to the front lines, be visible, be present. I'm often advising my clients to get off of, I call it Mahogany Row, you know, the higher they go in the organization, they tend to isolate themselves, right? Not intentionally, but it happens. Right? Mm-hmm. So by the time I'm working with somebody who's an executive VP or a CEO, they're in the highest corner office, farthest away from the front lines. Mm-hmm. They've got four layers of people protecting them from the outside world or even others in the organization. And they're flying in private jets and they're being driven by chauffeurs and, you know, they're isolated. They need to get better connected with their organizations.
Yeah, I agree. And so you're right. There is that literal physical disconnect that exists. And if we could break down even that most basic of barriers, that could be a really, really significant win in and of itself, just because they're the ones that are going to be able to provide some interesting data that might help any executive leader make a decision that is really, really impactful. And so who knows? And thank you for saying those things. I love the management by walking around. That is such an easy thing to do, but it is so incredibly powerful because humans, as much as we want to think we are rational and that we're very fact or logical in our approach to things, we do have underlying needs of acceptance and to feel heard and to have these things. And Gallup's State of the American Workplace and some other, you know, data that I think that both Bill and I have seen at some point, it just shows that what it really takes to engage a person is really, really basic things around, are you having a chance to do your best work every day? Do you have a best friend at work? Are you getting feedback? You know, do you have an opinion and does it seem to count? And these things are all so simple and all they do require is management by walking around.
Exactly. At all levels. But mm-hmm. if it starts at the top and the incredible, positive, powerful impact that will result from an executive leader spending, you know, a few hours a week being very visible, close to the front lines or, you know, in the organization. Like I've worked with executives, and how do we actually get this done? Mm. You know, we go out and we engage their assistant to literally get on the calendar and let's go find 2 hours this week that, you know, we can schedule the executive to go wander around and go drop in on small gatherings of employees who are having a coffee break, to go down the many floors and many aisles of cubicles and literally, you know, drop in and visit with folks. And man, does the word spread rapidly throughout the organization that he or she cares.
Yep.
He or she came to see me. And, you know, they've even done television shows on this, you know, where, like, the undercover CEO who goes to see what it's really like, a day in the life of, you know, somebody driving a truck or a frontline employee. So and those kinds of things are great.
Yeah.
And I'm going to point out another thing about kind of the type of leader, the personality type, extroverts and introverts. So about 80% of the executive leaders are extrovert personality types. Interestingly, some of the brightest minds, the best strategists tend to be introverts, but occasionally you get an introvert CEO who really struggles with doing the on stage, all that stuff. It's kind of a job responsibility. So they get through that because they have to, and some of them are really good at it when they have to. The really effective ones are able to, I use the phrase, pollinate an organization through one-on-one connections. And these are the great leaders who go and make personal connection throughout the organization, who really do truly care. I mean, this is EQ at the highest levels. You know, they show up as a caring, compassionate leader, and it is, you know, time well spent in their organization. It's better spent there than in a meeting of the staff, which is where they tend to spend too much of their time.
Yeah, I agree. And as I was looking at, you know, your website over the weekend, Bill, I started to really kind of wrap my mind around what makes you authentically you. And there were some great quotes on your site. You know, and you even said this, I think, earlier in the dialogue, right? You know, you're working with high functioning people who want to go from good to great. And there's a section on your website that talked about, hey guys, it's lonely at the top. It can be really, really challenging to do the work that you're doing. And so there was also a quote, you know, trying to apply management skills to a leadership role is like trying to apply earthbound rules to outer space. And I just love the juxtaposition there.
It's a different world.
It totally is.
Yeah. And again, like if you've grown up as a manager, director, you're managing people, you're managing limited resources. But then you move into executive leadership. Well, now this job is all about painting a picture of a brighter tomorrow and how we're going to get there. That's a totally different set of skills. And you got promoted there because you did a great job of saving money or being the most efficient or, you know, doing good management tasks that promoted you to a leadership function. But now you're being asked to use muscles that, you know, you've never developed before.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, yeah, we've got to try to figure out, you know, what are those most needed muscles, to use an anatomical, you know, comparison, mm-hmm. and then go develop them fast and exercise them and put them to work. And it's just practice in a short period of time. If we can get focused on the few behaviors that will, you know, be the real difference makers, because this person's got a whole lot going on and will fall into a reactive pattern of behavior, just trying to keep their head above water, unless they can become very intentional about, you know, what they need to do to be an effective leader.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree. And I love that a metaphor, right, is how do we help paint a picture of a better tomorrow? And I can't remember who said it, but somebody had said at some point in the past, you know, a leader is a dealer in hope. And it's a really,
completely. Yep.
It's a very simple phrase, but it's a very powerful one, because when we think about it, it made me think of Robert Cialdini's work in his book Influence, and the six major laws of influence, and how do we move a person from point A to point B if we don't always know what his or her, you know, intro, extro, task versus people oriented style might be. There are just some overarching major laws of influence that can help move. And so the more that an executive leader understands those differences of the hows and the whats of communication, but also those overarching tactics of influence, painting a better picture of tomorrow actually becomes pretty easy. But to your point, it really happens experientially. It happens through learning those things really tactically. And you, you know, in the 25, 30 years that you've actually had leading organizations, you clearly had those opportunities, whether it was those moments that you had with the coach, whether it's you leading teams to be able to do, you know, really challenging things. But were there any really significant experiences that you look back to, Bill, that were really those experiential learning things that helped you grow?
Oh, completely. I think back on 29 transactions, M&A transactions, merger acquisition, 27 times we were the acquirer and 2 times we were the sellers. And I look back now on how we did that work with a lot of pride. And, you know, it's like, look, we didn't have the perfect formula, but our heart was in the right place and we did some really good work. We used a phrase, better together, with all the acquisitions that we did. We were trying to build an organization. So we were acquiring kind of like-minded companies and ones that were a good fit with us, but mostly were a good people fit. That's kind of what we were looking for. And I think that was kind of the secret to our success. And I see too many out there then and still today, you know, doing deals for the sake of doing a deal, or doing a deal because it looks good, the numbers look good, or the street likes it, but everybody knows that it's a total misfit culturally. And I would say that as I look back on it now, we were doing the right things for the right reasons. And now I get to actually consult with some very senior executives in this area and have been able to get them to ask themselves the right questions about what are my motives here, you know, and what matters most. And most important, to realize that there are lives involved here. This is not just a paper transaction, and it's not just money. I mean, every one of these companies comes with lots and lots and lots of employees whose livelihood depends on this business. And so many of these M&A transactions are based on, as soon as we merge these two companies together, we're going to get 30% immediate savings in, you know, administrative costs. But I mean, it means people are going to go. You know, I love to see the kind of real beneficial merger and acquisition activity where organizations come together, cultures blend, and, you know, the best of both, you know, 1 + 1 equals much more than 2. So I think that's, you know, my experience was a good one for the most part. And as I look back on it, I think it's because our heart was in the right place. So now I try to much more formally get people to consider, head, heart, and gut, you know, and make sure that all three are aligned and that we're doing this for the right reason and that the outcome is better for all, and mitigate the risks and do the right thing.
I was with an organization recently, and when they talked about similar transactions and even some of the smaller scale decisions that they were making around strategic objectives for the following year, they said that they actively began the discussion by talking about which of the core values they were going to look at the discussion through. And it was a really interesting tactic that I hadn't considered before, but somewhat similar to the things that you're talking about or wanting to make recommendations to an executive around, is that we do have to take into consideration the human perspective and experience here, because yes, what the organization's going to become is better together. And yes, are there going to be some cost savings? Of course, but there are going to be those lives are affected. And how do we show as much compassion or care for them as we possibly can? And big kudos to you in the way that you conduct yourself, Bill, is that we're just moving to a place where the human, I think, oftentimes comes before short-term quarterly profits. And that's probably what millennials want more than anything else. So kudos to you for trying to find that balance between what does the street need, but what does the human need too?
Right. And, you know, I am just so encouraged by the positive direction of, you know, efforts like conscious capitalism, particularly to help companies who have an interest in doing the right thing, in doing good, to realize that you can do good in the world through your business and do well in your business. Mm-hmm. So it's very possible. And there are lots of organizations who do that and who are really willing to share their story and invite people in. And, you know, it's a great organization and one that I would encourage people to kind of check out in your own neighborhood. Yeah. And see, I mean, there are chapters developing in all major markets already in the U.S. and around the world. So, you know, if you have an interest in a real values-based business, that's a great place to find like-minded people.
I agree. And it just so happens that, and we didn't talk about this in the pre-show, but the Conscious Capitalism chapter in Arizona happens to be hosting the Conscious Capitalism National event next April.
And we just did it here in Dallas.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Okay, great. So fantastic. And so there's the likelihood that, you know, Bill and my paths are going to cross again at some point very soon as a result of this.
I will see you there.
Okay, good. Okay, great. And this is the beautiful thing, is that you're right. From an organization considering B Corp status to thinking about conscious capitalism and how do we do good but also do well simultaneously, and triple bottom line, people, planet, profit, right? Steve Elkington back in the late 1970s. These things really matter, especially to the younger generation, but they're also just really good business as societal norms shift. You know, I've seen this happen a lot myself, and my guess is you might have too, is that we've been in this place in society where since about 2003, 2004, 2005, the focus has been on very individualistic accomplishment. And I think we're moving to this place where kind of this collaboration, consensus building, let's achieve things together because we are better together. This idea of social connectedness seems to be taking hold and driving. And my gut tells me is that you've had some really key relationships, Bill, in your journey that have really helped you through this. I mean, would you agree?
Absolutely. I've had great role models and I've been able to learn from them. I have also discovered in all this work, becoming a coach, getting certified, you know, all the instruments and tools that are available, is that there is a lot of good work that's been done to help expedite this, help show the way to make it happen faster and more effectively, and to be able to measure the economic benefits in addition to the human benefit of running a business in a better way. Mm-hmm. So it's the leadership imperative for executives is to how to help your organization evolve to a higher standard. There's much more to it than just your quarterly performance.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Who are we and what is the work we're called to do and who do we intend to be and who do we want to include and what's possible for us as an organization?
Yeah. And so those role models really do help to give us different perspectives that we wouldn't have considered. And that's why you and I do the work that we do, is that we want to be able to offer a slightly different angle or perspective to help people become the best and most authentic versions of themselves. And like we talked about a little bit in the pre-show, I'm a really big fan of continual growth and development. You know, I've got some certifications, you've got certifications, we've both hired coaches. I'm a big fan of personal trainers, you know, hiring therapists for tough situations. I really think about those things as being a critical lever for any person to pull as they're going through a significant adjustment or change, because that seems to be something that's really guaranteed in human life, is that we're going to be confronted by those challenging scenarios and situations. It's best to have a person who has systems or processes or who knows how to facilitate you through something that's challenging. And not only do you get to do it, Bill, on a day-to-day basis, but my guess is that you've had some of those subject matter experts around you too.
Yeah, oh gosh. And so I'm so grateful for all the mentors that I've had. And just as you said, therapists, coaches, the resources that are available to help us on our personal individual journey to find our way, and, you know, just connect with all of those that you possibly can. But let me add also that today I'm really grateful for the many teachers I've had who have showed me how not to do things, how I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
So there are times in our careers where we just feel totally stuck because someone or something is holding us back or in our way. Look, we've got a bad boss, or it's, you know, we're just in a bad situation and we feel stuck and it feels like it's out of our control. All I can say is I have the gift of hindsight many years later, but I see now how much I benefited from seeing how that person's, you know, bad behavior taught me how not to do things.
Yeah.
And I was a better person for it. It was a painful experience, and I can't say I'd want to relive it.
Right.
But I remember at times being in, I had a difficult boss, difficult board, you know, some situation that made my life difficult. And I could have fallen into the poor me victim role, but instead I got through it. Today I can see how much it benefited me, because I would never act that way as a result of having had that experience.
Yeah, I agree. One of the things that I think is so fantastic in that is that we are all going to experience the challenges. We are all going to make mistakes. We're all going to fail in some capacity. The real resilient people are the ones that can say, hey, gosh, you know what? I learned through this particular experience. Let me find a way to be able to share my learnings collectively or my mistakes collectively with the group so that this doesn't happen again. And that's a really important thing, because it's quick and easy to get into this kind of victim, woe is me mentality. And you should definitely experience your emotions in whatever way you need to. So please do. But we also need to be very cognizant of saying, okay, gosh, this thing happened. Here are the three major things that I learned from this. Let's advance this forward.
That's right. This thing called life is the hero's journey.
Oh, yes.
And we are going to face, we're going to get a few bumps and bruises and face our obstacles.
Totally true.
We live and grow from them. Yeah.
And when we do. And so that's the blessing, is that now when you think about some of those clients that you've served in the last 4 or 5 years, Bill, they've obviously had some challenges. You know, what are some of the recurring challenges that you see them encounter?
I would characterize a good portion of the folks I work with as being superstars. I mean, these are folks at companies like Apple and SpaceX. And so these are superstars who are moving into the executive ranks. And so they've got all the right stuff. They've been moving fast thus far into their career. They may be 10, 15 years into their career, and now they're being placed in a really big job. Some of the characteristics we see kind of commonly among that group is this idea of getting work done through others. Because they've been so self-reliant to this point, they've been rock star individual contributors, and they've been asked to manage or head up a department. But now as an executive leader, again, it's a whole new set of skills that are needed. And so we take them through, in that case, we use a Korn Ferry Glominger Voices instrument, which measures 67 business competencies that are highly correlated with success in the workplace. And I will say they almost all show up, you know, with really strong, you know, they know their stuff, people skills, and the ability to inspire and attract others and to confront, have difficult, challenging conversations is an area that we often work on. And more than anything, it's the ability to get things done through others. Because I've never needed to before.
Yeah, that's a big one. And so we talked earlier at the beginning of the show with regards to some other certification that you have, like how have you been able to apply the Leadership Circle Profile or the anything that comes out of the Hogan Group? Like how have those been applied?
Yeah, so my favorite, I would say, is for senior level executives is the Leadership Circle Profile. It is an exceptional instrument that incorporates all of the, I think, the greatest wisdom in this field. It is about my leadership effectiveness. And this one is not about my job competency. It's about my leadership effectiveness. And so it will reveal for the participant, what are my reactive patterns of behavior? We all have them. They fall in basically three categories. We're either the complying type, the protecting type, or controlling type. Mm-hmm. And it will show, it will subcategorize ways that we show up to indicate that. And we just come to understand that and to realize how that is not working for us. And again, this is when we're under stress. How do we react? How do we show up? And then it reveals 18 creative competencies that we all would want to have lots of. And we see how we're doing, how we're showing up in those. And then we'll identify the ones that are opportunities for development and be able to prioritize kind of what's needed most in my role as a leader in this organization. And we go to work on developing the most needed creative competencies. And there's a sort of a magical effect of making the reactive patterns of behavior diminish. I mean, it's as if they evaporate. So we don't have to try too hard to stop doing anything. We focus our attention on the start doing the key behaviors that will make the reactive patterns of behavior evaporate.
And
we get amazing results. Amazing. Mm. It's very pinpointed very quickly. And this is exactly what you need as an executive leader. You don't have time to try to do all things. You got to get to the most essential, most important leadership qualities that need to be developed. And look, sometimes you find blind spots. You find some real surprises. You get your own self-assessment compared to how others perceive you. And where there are significant differences, you know, that is an opportunity for, you know, for some real deep exploration. So many benefits that come out of it. But it takes into account, as you were speaking earlier, the task to relationship orientation. Do you mm-hmm. tend to get things done through people or get things done, you know, through task? Again, creative and reactive. Is the yin yang, you know, forces working there? It's a beautiful instrument that really reveals the most essential qualities for leader development. I find it to be really practical. That's a senior level executive tool. Korn Ferry Voices is great for kind of mid-level, kind of director to VP in large organizations. Perfectly suited for that. I use it a lot. Mm-hmm. I use the Hogan more on an individual basis. It really helps people come to know their values, you know, what drives their behavior, mm-hmm. And helps them connect, you know, make sure they're in the right role in the right place and kind of understand who I am and how do I fit in this organization. It's also an excellent predictor of success. Mm-hmm. And again, it helps people see if I'm in the right place doing the right things, and if not, what do I need to develop? It will point out what could be career derailers. And that's also another really valuable tool set, I would say, for kind of director to VP level executives.
Yeah, that's great. And thank you for sharing those things. I think I've heard of them in the marketplace, but not actually been exposed to them directly myself. So your descriptions of them are fantastic because they're obviously very, very applicable to the folks that you're serving day to day. And you've done brilliantly to share, here are the challenges and here are the way that these particular things and assessments and instruments can bring some sort of clarity. Because I think with the work that you and I end up doing on a day-to-day basis is how to trigger essentially new habits to form. And so when we think about what are those things that in those moments of indecision, you know, how do we move to a place of making new decisions that we might not have made historically better in better interests of ourselves and the folks we serve or the firm that we serve as a whole?
Exactly. And it may not be the things we want to work on. It may be the things that the people tell us. You know, you do a 360 and you have, let's say, 15 to 20 people providing input. You know, if the survey reveals that there are two or three things that you're being perceived in a way that is not working for you, you pay attention to that. That needs to be your highest priority.
Yeah.
That perception is your reality and warrants attention. And that's where we go to work. So I typically work on a 6-month engagement with a client. We, you know, within the first 30 days, get that assessment completed. And so by, you know, 45 days, we've got the results. And by 60 days, we've got an action plan in place. The remainder of the time, we are into action. That executive is into action, making changes. And we're meeting every couple of weeks to make course corrections, get feedback. How did that work? They are exercising new muscles that they've never used before. They're doing new and what feel like awkwardly uncomfortable things,
right,
to try to develop new patterns of behavior. Like you said, it's not a once and done thing. I mean, the change takes time and it takes concerted effort. And quite honestly, it takes accountability. I mean, the fact that that executive has a meeting with the coach 3 days from now is what usually inspires them to do their homework.
Mm-hmm. It's so true.
So, because they're busy all the time. They've got a lot going on, right?
Yep.
And so the fact that they have a commitment, it does cause them to get into action.
And then
I want to point out, we measure everything. Mm. We set those objectives early, like at day 60, and then we say, okay, so what does success look like in 3 months and in 6 months, and how will we know? How are we going to measure this? Okay, let's put metrics on it and then be able to test at a pause point or at the end of the engagement, how's this person doing? Mm. And I can't run a full 360 again, every time. So we've got to find practical ways to get effective measurements to know that we're getting results.
Yeah, I so agree. There have been so many folks that I've come across in my journey that did not do a great job of establishing those goals or those expectations early on. And you can see that they end up struggling quite a bit more over the long term, because even if they did have really massive success, the team around them didn't have appropriate expectations. And so really setting those metrics around what success looks like is a brilliant strategy early on for any coach that's listening today to say, okay, let's really, really drive towards something that we both agree to in a very meaningful way. And so, Bill, you talked about Apple and you talked about American Airlines and you talked about SpaceX. Like, what other firms have you been able to serve in your journey?
Well, quite a few of them are in the Fortune 500. I mean, I tend to work with larger companies, but I'm working with Shell and BP and MGM Resorts, McKesson, doing a lot of medical work with them. John Deere, great organization, good people. Abbott Labs, C-level executives at Time Inc. prior to their recent merger. Interstate Batteries, which is a leading company in the conscious capitalism environment, worked with a couple of their CEO or C-level executives. Christie's, the art people.
Yep.
CAE, Simuflight in aviation. One of the groups I wanted to mention that I love working with is Rice University in Houston, Doerr Institute for New Leaders, which is in existence for about 4 years now. A gift of John and Ann Doerr alums who made a contribution to establish this institute for leader development for university students. So Rice is a top 15 university already. So they've got exceptionally talented, bright, high IQ students who the Doerrs wanted to help enhance their ability to impact the world in a positive way by helping develop leadership skills at a very formative time in their life. So,
so
there's a group of us who are professional coaches who work with students, undergraduates and graduate students, both. And in that case, we start with an EQ assessment and get them to understand where they are and what opportunities they have for personal development there, how they can develop leadership skills, even in the university environment. And that could be, I've worked with some student body presidents, but it could also be even in a small study group. What is their opportunity to have positive influence and to attract others to their ideas of even on an academic issue?
No doubt.
So practicing leadership skills in those formative years so that they can have bigger impact on the world, because they're already coming out, they're among the highest IQ. Let's give them EQ and some leadership skills too, so they can come out and impact the world with a longer tenure ahead of them. Really cool stuff. A lot of other universities are now looking to Rice, and Rice is freely sharing everything that they've done and what they've learned thus far, trying to expand leader development for the next generation.
That's awesome. That's fantastic really cool that stuff. They're almost open sourcing it and saying, hey, here's what we've learned, here's what you can do, because this is what's going to create the real true leaders of our future. And so, Bill, we've been in the last probably 45 or 50 minutes, been able to cover a ton of information. So thank you. We'll close out with a couple of questions. You and I are both really big into learning and loving to learn, but are there books or podcasts or research videos, are there specific things that you've leaned on over the years that we could share with the audience that they might be able to explore themselves?
Well, we've touched on a few, and I would repeat that I think for business, I love Jim Collins' work on Good to Great and Built to Last. I was also very much impacted by Marshall Goldsmith's work, What Got You Here Won't Get You There. And I would say that's probably the book that I hand out to clients more than any other, because, again, as you're moving up in an organization into roles of executive leadership, Marshall gives you the list of 20 things you got to stop doing, right? Like, stop showing up as the smartest person in the room.
Yep.
Some really good, simple, straightforward behavior checks. Everybody ought to read that book if you get promoted to sort of a VP level job or above. And I'll bet you that you're doing 10 of them on day one in your new job. I was guilty of it too. So anyway, that's a really good practice.
It's a big one.
I love Brené Brown's work.
Yep.
All of her stuff. I'm a big fan of Greg McKeown's essentialism.
Okay.
I find, you know, people are just busy all the time and we just have so much information and we're just also overwhelmed that simplifying is just such a necessity for us.
Yeah.
I think we talked a little bit about introverts and extroverts and Susan Cain's work. Introverts, the power of introverts in a world that won't stop talking. I mean, yep. our world, our business world, you know, rewards extroverts and promotes extroverts.
Yep.
And I think part of her message is to CEOs today saying, your smartest people, your best strategists and some of your best thinkers in your organization are introverts and you're passing them up. You know, you're not seeing that.
So, yep. Yep.
I love the fact that she's spreading that word. I've always loved the art of possibility.
Okay.
That's a classic. And Daniel Goleman's work on emotional intelligence.
Yep.
And then, you know, we were talking about the Leadership Circle Profile. A fabulous book that came out last year is called Mastering Leadership by Bob Anderson and Bill Adams, who created the Leadership Circle Profile and the organization around it. And they have a new book coming out called Scaling Leadership, and that one comes out in January. And it kind of takes it to the next level, which is actually how to scale this throughout your organization. So nice. Mastering Leadership is more about sort of C-level executive leadership, and Scaling Leadership will take it deeper into the organization. So highly recommend those. Great resources.
Nice. Nice. And thank you for sharing that list. For both of us, you and I are both really, really, it sounds like avid readers and just love to be able to stay current with what's kind of happening and what does it actually take to move the needle. So in closing, Bill, are there any pieces of advice or maybe one piece of advice that you'd like to offer, you know, many of the executives that you serve or other people in the community that are looking to break free from whatever has been holding them back or it's something that they're looking to become? Like, what's the advice you'd like to offer them?
So let's all try to live more intentionally. And so I'd offer a few questions on how do I really do that? How do I practically do that? So if I want to live more intentionally, I'm going to act as if I've got 10 years left to live.
Okay.
And if that's true, or if I make that assumption, how would you start living your life differently? What's the 1% difference you could make tomorrow, you know, to improve your life? Because clock's ticking, right?
Yep, yep.
And then people relationship, you know, who matters most to you?
Yep.
And who do you want to spend the most time with? Here's the hard question is how are you going to let them know that they matter to you?
Yep.
So go take that action to let them know and do just the 1% positive difference tomorrow. That, you know, if we don't have the benefit of living a long, long life ahead, let's just assume we've only got a limited time. Let's try to live more intentionally.
Oh, that's amazing. And thank you so much for sharing that. We certainly, like we talked about throughout our conversation, there's been this need to just take a whole bunch of action because that's what society is doing or that's how we need to keep up. And if we could just get really hyper-focused in on our personal mission and say, what is our intent, right? What is it that we want out of life? What's the legacy we're going to leave? I think that's where there's really significant power. So Bill, I want to thank you so much for your time today and just acknowledge and honor you for a variety of things that you have shared about your own journey, the mentors you had, the various things that happened throughout the 80s and 90s for you, how you were an overachiever. And now, of course, you're able to coach and kind of consult with overachievers to really helping the audience think about influence, think about that there are, you know, extroverts kind of run society and businesses. And 80% of the leaders that we see are that. How you've been able to facilitate and be a part of 29, you know, mergers and acquisitions. And that's a huge number. But thinking about that, when we go through those, we are better together, right? And it really does matter. And sharing a little bit about the value that the role models, mentors, therapists, you know, teachers, people that you've had in your life have helped you avoid the victim mentality, work yourself through the hero's journey, and really help to drive to where you're at now, being able to coach executives at Apple and SpaceX and Shell and BP and MGM Resorts. You've clearly been able to impact a lot of really, really high-ranking folks in the corporate world. And you've read a ton of books and you've got this background and this context, I think, that very few people do. And it's really informed your capacity to not only facilitate change in their lives, but also to really, really help them live intentionally. So I want to acknowledge you for that and for everything that you've done.
Wow. Thank you, Michael. Thank you for all this work you're doing. I mean, you're sharing so much and with so many, so freely.
Yeah.
So thank you for that. Keep exploring, and thanks for sharing this good work that you're doing.
Of course. It's
been a pleasure. Yeah. Pleasure to be with you.
Of course. Yeah, and thank you. So what website can people go, Bill, to be able to learn a little bit more about you?
BillKoch.coach, okay. BillKoch.coach, also at KochLeadership.com. On LinkedIn, just search Bill Koch, KOCH, Coach, Dallas. You'll get there.
We'll find you. That's awesome. All right, Bill. So thank you so much again for your time. And for everybody listening, thank you for investing time both into Bill and I. This has been another tremendous, tremendous episode of Equal Chance to Be Unequal. I wish you all a fantastic day. Go forth and be awesome. Thank you for listening to this episode of Equal Chance to Be Unequal. I'm Michael S. Siever. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on iTunes and like, share, or comment on this podcast on michaelsiever.com, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, Twitter, or YouTube. Go forth and be awesome.